Five of Professor Zhu's collaborators, who are now professors at Fudan, were also trained at Yale, explained Levin. One was Professor Zhu's friend when both were Yale graduate students. Another was a visiting scholar in the laboratory of a Yale colleague. One was an exchange student who came to Yale from Fudan and returned to earn his Ph.D. in China. And the other two were postdoctoral fellows in Professor Zhu's Yale lab. A similar story underlies the formation of the Peking-Yale Joint Center for Plant Molecular Genetics and Agrobiotechnology. Professor Zhu is a leading expert on genetics and has won grants from the National Institutes of Health and the Howard Hughes Foundation to study the connection between genetics and cancer and certain neurodegenerative diseases. This kind of research requires the study of large numbers of genetic mutations in lab animals. When you want to test many genes and trace for a given gene that may be responsible for certain diseases, you need to run a lot of tests. Having a bigger staff is a huge advantage, explained Levin. So what Yale did was essentially outsource the lab work to Fudan by creating the Fudan-Yale Biomedical Research Center. Each university pays for its own staff and research, so no money changes hands. But the Chinese side does the basic technical work using large numbers of technicians and lab animals, which costs so much less in China. And Yale does the high-end analysis of the data. The Fudan staff, students, and technicians get great exposure to high-end research, and Yale gets a large-scale testing facility that would have been prohibitively expensive if Yale had tried to duplicate it in New Haven. A support lab in America for a project like this one might have 30 technicians, but the one in Fudan has 150. The gains are very much two-way, said Levin. Our investigators get substantially enhanced productivity, and the Chinese get their graduate students trained, and their young faculty become collaborators with our professors, who are the leaders in their fields. It builds human capital for China and innovation for Yale. Graduate students from both universities go back and forth, forging relationships that will no doubt produce more collaborations in the future. At the same time, he added, a lot of legal preparation went into this collaboration to make sure that Yale would be able to harvest the intellectual property that is created. There is one world of science out there, said Levin, and this kind of international division of labor makes a lot of sense. Yale, he said, also insisted that the working conditions at the Chinese labs be world-class, and as a result, it has also helped to lift the quality of the Chinese facilities. The living conditions of the lab animals are right up to U.S. standards, remarked Levin. These are not mouse sweatshops. Put all the above together, and you have America's secret sauce, a mix of institutions, laws, and cultural norms that produce a level of trust, innovation, and collaboration that has enabled us to thrive for more than two centuries and constantly renew our economy and raise our standard of living. There is nothing about the flat world, nothing that Americans cannot handle, as long as we roll up our sleeves, educate our young people the right way for these times, and tend to and enrich the secrets of our sauce. So are we doing that? That's what the next two chapters are about. But let me give you a hint. The answer is no.
The Quiet Crisis. The truth is, we are in a crisis now, but it is a crisis that is unfolding very slowly and very quietly. It is a quiet crisis, explained Shirley Ann Jackson, the 2004 president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute since 1999. And this quiet crisis involves the steady erosion of America's scientific and engineering base, which has always been the source of American innovation and our rising standard of living. The sky is not falling. Nothing horrible is going to happen today, said Jackson, a physicist by training who chooses her words carefully. The U.S. is still the leading engine for innovation in the world. It has the best graduate programs, the best scientific infrastructure, and the capital markets to exploit it. But there is a quiet crisis in U.S. science and technology that we have to wake up to. The U.S. today is in a truly global environment, and those competitor countries are not only wide awake, they are running a marathon while we are running sprints. If left unchecked, this could challenge our preeminence and capacity to innovate. It is our ability to constantly innovate new products, services, and companies that has been the source of America's horn of plenty and steadily widening middle class for the last two centuries. It was American innovators who started Google, Intel, HP, Dell, Microsoft, and Cisco, and it matters where innovation happens. The fact that all these companies are headquartered in America means that most of the high-paying jobs are here, even if these companies outsource or offshore some functions. The executives, the department heads, the sales force, and the senior researchers are all located in the cities where the innovation happened. And their jobs create more jobs. The shrinking of the pool of young people with the knowledge skills to innovate won't shrink our standard of living overnight. It will be felt only in 15 or 20 years when we discover we have a critical shortage of scientists and engineers capable of doing innovation or even just high-value-added technology work. Then this won't be a quiet crisis anymore, said Jackson. It will be the real McCoy. By the time Jackson took the job as Rensselaer Polytechnic's president to put her heart and soul into reinvigorating American science and engineering, she realized, she said, that a perfect storm was brewing, one that posed a real long-term danger to America's economic health, and she started speaking out about it whenever she could. The way to avoid being caught in such a storm is to identify the confluence of factors and to change course, even though right now the sky is blue, the winds are gentle, and the water seems calm. In the fiscal year 2005 budget passed by the Republican-led Congress in November 2004, the budget for the National Science Foundation, which is the federal body most responsible for promoting research and funding more and better science education, was actually cut by 1.9%, or $105 million. History will show that when America should have been doubling the NSF funding, its Congress passed a pork-laden budget that actually cut assistance for science and engineering. Don't be fooled by the calm. That's always the time to change course, not when you're just about to get hit by the typhoon. We don't have any time to waste in addressing the dirty little secrets of our education system.